Welcome to Crime Over Wine Weekly. It's Monday, March 25th. I'm Liam Collins. Here are your crime headlines. Journal entries written by former family YouTube vlogger Ruby Frankie detail horrifics of how she abused her children for years. The journal entries described how she forced her daughter to stand in the rain for 2 hours. Another said her son was pushed into a pool and she admitted to holding her hand, quote, tightly over his nose and mouth, supposedly in an effort to save him. Ruby wrote in one entry that it was, quote, a big day for evil. Ruby received 4 separate sentences of 1 to 15 years each. Her business partner, Jody Hildebrandt, received the same sentence after they both pleaded guilty to second-degree aggravated child abuse in August. Police say they found one of Ruby's sons with open wounds and bound with duct tape. There's resolution in that bizarre case of an Alabama woman who faked her own kidnapping in July of 2023. Carly Russell pleaded guilty to 2 counts of filing a false police report. Carly called 911 and told police she saw a young child walking along a highway. When police arrived, they found her car and some of her personal belongings, but Carly was nowhere to be found. Carly returned home 4 days later, saying she was abducted and held hostage, but later escaped her captors. But she later admitted it was all a lie. Carly was sentenced to 1 year of probation, 100 hours of community service, and almost $18,000 in fines and mental health counseling. A second murder trial against a New Hampshire man accused of killing 2 women in 2017 started last week. Timothy Verrill is accused of speeding and stabbing Christine Sullivan and Jenna Pellegrini before he put their bodies under the porch. Timothy was previously found to be guilty of the crimes, but a judge declared a mistrial in 2019, saying police had mishandled some evidence. Last week, prosecutors pointed to DNA found on several objects in the house, including ice melt. Investigators argued he used to hide blood stains. Timothy's attorneys argued prosecutors had tunnel vision. The jury heard from a previous drug associate of Timothy's who said Timothy was acting odd and paranoid around the time of the murders. And this week on Crime Over Wine Weekly, the search for an autistic teenager is ramping up again in Middle Tennessee with a hit from cadaver dogs over the weekend. How volunteers are stepping in to help find Sebastian Rogers. Plus, a teenage boy missing out of Denver for over 3 months is spotted, the latest in the search for Diego Hernandez. But first, we have some wine to talk about, of course. I am joined by Michelle Heron and Heather Holly, as always. Hello, ladies. Hope everyone is having a kick butt weekend.
Hello.
Hi. It's been very kick butt-ish.
Well, that's good. Kick butt-ish. That's close enough, right? What a week in true crime. We've had a lot of stuff going on, specifically in Tennessee, right? So we talked about Sebastian Rogers. We're going to talk about that, but we also had the Riley Strain case as well, which has, you know, gotten a lot of attention in Nashville. Nashville has had a lot of really intense crime stories the last couple of months. We talked about Emily Bradley a couple weeks ago on Crime Over Wine Weekly, Riley Strain, Sebastian Rogers. There's just been a lot going on, I feel like, in Tennessee.
Yeah, I won't be going to Nashville.
Yeah, some people have been like, what's in the water there?
Well, listen, Michelle, I know you lived there for a while. I mean, it's just a very, like, rambunctious town, right? I mean, you have to say, I mean, like, that has to be noted, but, like, a lot of that doesn't really relate to, like, the cases that we were talking about or that have been making headlines. I mean, the Riley Strain case, of course, does. But other than that, like none of the other cases that we're talking about, you know, really has anything to do with like, you know, the reputation that Nashville has, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. It really is just kind of that's the way the cookie crumbles type thing. But I will just say it's a city, you know, a city that's been growing the last like 10 plus years and is gonna continue to grow, and there's just a lot going on. And you know, there's just unfortunately been some crazy things happening. And I think it's just a reminder to, you know, be vigilant about what's going on around you and those who you love, and don't be afraid to speak up if something just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point. And because of the kind of reputation, I suppose, that Nashville does have, it does like tend to attract, you know, frankly, a lot of people and a certain type of person, you know, people who, you know, like to live on the edge kind of stuff. I mean, it's we literally call it Nash Vegas, the Vegas of the East Coast. And so there's a reason for that. Right. And so, yeah, but to your point, Michelle, it can happen anywhere. Right. And it happens everywhere on a regular basis. So Well, we have some wine to drink this week. Heather, it was Heather's week to pick out the wine, which means that she must love it this week. Hopefully, otherwise, then I just don't think we have much hope for Heather, frankly.
Yeah, I make no promises that I will enjoy this at all. There was no logical thought process. It was logical, but I removed my preferences from it. I knew we hadn't had a red in a while, so I wanted to pick a red. And I went to Publix hoping I wouldn't be as overwhelmed with all the choices. And Publix has a nifty little chart of like little diagrams that are going to be on the stickers that represent different flavor. Like, so I picked one of those and then picked the bottle I liked the best with that design. And that's how we ended up with Love Noir.
I do really like the label. I will say that.
So the actual description that I didn't read before I bought it, I just picked it because I thought it was pretty. Love Noir is a luxurious fruit forward take on Pinot Noir. In this unique style, richness and decadence are balanced with subtle structure to form layers of luxurious flavor from the first alluring sip to the last robust jammy flavors of dark cherry and rich espresso spark intensity and intrigue and lead to a smooth, balanced finish with soft hints of vanilla and toasted oak. Succumb to your urges and experience Love Noir.
Not intrigue.
Succumb to your urges.
Very Phantom of the Opera.
Right. I feel like it's just enough mystery for like Crime Over Wine Weekly, you know? Well, cheers. Cheers to you, ladies.
Cheers. Ooh, I like this.
Fruit forward.
Like the fruity, like, reminds me of like a fruit roll-up, you know?
Oh, yeah, kind of, actually. Yeah, it's a very sweet fruit-forward kind of wine. Fills the mouth. It's front-forward, though, too. You don't. I'm not getting a whole lot in the back of the mouth. I'm getting it, like, right at the tip of the tongue, it feels like.
I am getting the oakiness in the back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's definitely Pinot Noir-esque, for sure. Yeah, actually, I do get a good bit of oak as the flavors kind of come out a little bit in the back. And it's very subtle. Like I kind of looked for it. It was like oakiness. It's more so, I feel like the espresso than the oak, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Maybe the espresso vanilla a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know. You're speaking too advanced for me. I don't know. It tastes like wine and it's pretty good.
That's why I love Heather.
I should really put that in the review. official wine commentator says, tastes like wine and it's pretty good.
There's so many people that will relate. Like,
yeah, that's fair.
I've been very forward that I don't know.
This is fair. This is why Crime Over Wine Weekly is for everybody, right? Like, you know, you can come with like lots of experience, you can come with like not a whole lot of experience, and you come with like basically no experience at all and like still have a good time. So that's why we're here. Love it for us. Well, the case, Johnny Gosch, right? Like, I mean, I was researching this case, and I was just scudding down more and more rabbit holes. Like, there was just so much in here that I could not include in this episode, and, like, we had to divide it up into two parts. So it's like, there's just so much going on here. Like, it's intense. What are your thoughts?
So I have to say, I did not know that it was divided into two parts, and so, like... ultimate cliffhanger. Like, you literally end it with...
I thought you were being a little salty toward me this week.
Yeah. The mom gets a letter from one of the abductors, and I'm like, what did the freaking letter say? And then it's like, there's going to be a part two. And I was like, Liam! I was definitely, like, sucked in, you know, that because that is... I've heard of that case before, and I've watched some things on it, but... just the way that you and Megan were talking about it, like, I was totally in a trance, like, listening to what you guys were saying.
Yeah, listen, wait until part two is all I have to say about that, because I don't know how much you know about the case, but, like, whoo, there is a cliffhanger at the back end that is just too unreal. I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say about it next week. But I just, so, and this reminds me, and I know that Megan talked about it at some point, but just like how the unluckiness of this case, right? Like the fact that, like, you know, it was just happened to be like the one time that John decided not to go out with Johnny on his paper route. Like, it was all these different people. It just felt like the perfect set of circumstances to just like result in just a really bad situation. And obviously cases with children just like hurt me, but like in so many different ways, but like, man, I couldn't take it.
And I think this is like one of the first cases that really kind of highlights like the issue of like sex trafficking. Because even though there is like that dark underside of the world out there, a lot of people that don't have anything to do with that don't even realize that that's going on. And I think that that's like really one of the first cases to like show like this is going on, you know, this is dangerous. I think he's still alive today. I mean, I think there's just been too many things that have happened that have proved that he was out there. I think he's still alive today.
I don't know if I think he's alive.
I don't know. I go back. I could really go either way. Like there's just so much I can't say. Like, I feel like without like revealing like so much of what's in part two, but I really go back and forth because if he's not still out there, in my opinion, there's just so much that people have said that isn't true and is too good to be true, because there's just a lot of information that has been put forward that supports, in my opinion, the fact that he's still alive, or at the very least was still alive the last time that that anyone has interacted with any of these people. And like, if that's true, then man, like what a life, right? Like how traumatic of a life that must be to live. But if it's not, then I feel like I have so many more questions, and I can't really tell whether or not I have more questions if he is out there or if he's not out there.
One of the things that is sticking with me still about this case is the law enforcement aspect. And learning about the wrongdoings there, and that there's a lot going on there. But like the fact that the chief was out there being like, stop looking for him, and they were volunteers. Mind your business. It's free country. They're allowed to assemble if they want to and look for a lost kid, because you won't. And then just learning about his criminal background, I'm kind of surprised that there wasn't more push for change in the search for missing kids at that point.
Yeah, well, so to be clear, so there was a lot of action that was actually taken like very shortly after Johnny Gosch went missing, just to be clear, like federally. And so there was like a good bit of like, you know, pushing. On the note of like the investigators, like again, it just like, if like I go back to the fact of like, if that had nothing to do with Johnny Gosch's disappearance and it just happened to be like really bad investigators that just like, you know, put like really bad tastes in people's mouths. Again, I go back to like how unlucky that Johnny Gosch happened to go missing in this town that just had a really terrible police department, that were up to some really bad things at the time, or really sketchy things at the time, specifically from the police chief. Or if it wasn't like, you know, wrong place, wrong time kind of situation, then like, let's look there, right? Like, it feels like it can't be like either there were some really weird things going on, or there were some really weird things going on. You know what I mean? Like, that's, I just keep going like, again, I feel like it's one of those situations where it's just like, if you take this path, then, you know, because you believe this is true, then like it opens up all these other paths and all these different questions. But if you took the other path, it just opens up a whole different set of paths and a whole different set of questions.
Yeah, I agree with that, Liam.
You guys have seen what I have been like for the past several weeks researching this case. This is exactly how every time I would read another article, I'd be like, what? And like type away on my little computer. So welcome to my brain. Anyways. Man, all right. Well, we have a lot of cases to talk about on this week's episode, though, on Crime Over Wine Weekly, absent Crime Over Wine. So y'all want to get there?
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. The case of the Boeing whistleblower found dead in his car gets even weirder. What he accused his employer of doing to him years before he died. We have that and a lot more coming up in news of the week.
But first, 18 years ago, next Monday, April 1st, Brian Schaefer disappeared from a bar in downtown Columbus, Ohio. He has not been seen since, and he was never actually seen leaving the bar. If you know anything, call the Columbus Police Department at 614-645-4545 and listen to his story on episode 29 of Crime Over Wine. Crime Over Wine is sponsored by BetterHelp. As someone who's used therapy for years, I know that finding a therapist can sometimes be a stress on its own, juggling your full-time job, your family, your friends, your podcast, and trying to find the right therapist on top of that can almost feel impossible. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp matches you with a therapist that works for you on your terms. It's online, it's remote, and by filling out a few questions, BetterHelp can match you to one of 33,000 licensed professional therapists in as little as a few days. And because finding a new therapist is a lot like finding a new bottle of wine, if you don't jive with your therapist, you can easily switch to a new one at no additional cost. You can get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by going to betterhelp.com/crimeoverwine. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crimeoverwine for 10% off your first month. Join over 4 million people who decided to get help and get happy with BetterHelp.
Hello, Crime Over Wine listeners. I am Rachel.
And I'm Heather.
We are the hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder.
We bring you the good, the badass, and the crime.
Each week, we bring you stories from missing and murdered
to survivors and women who empower you.
And of course, some mom talk sprinkled in.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts at Like Mother, Like Murder.
And give us a follow on social media so that we can say hi.
Okay, love you, bye.
Okay, love you, bye.
All right, y'all, as if we didn't have enough to talk about when we talked about this case last week, even more has come out about the death of John Barnett. The case of John Barnett's supposed suicide is getting even stranger. This is the Boeing whistleblower we told you about last week. Well, according to WCSC, the CBS affiliate in Charleston, John claimed to have been, quote, harassed, denigrated, humiliated, and treated with scorn and contempt by his managers while he worked at Boeing. According to the lawsuit filed in 2017, which was the same year John retired from Boeing, he was pushed to work outside of FAA standards and was told he was put onto a list of 49 managers to, quote, get rid of. The lawsuit also says John filed a complaint in June of 2014 that he caught another manager spying on him, but there wasn't a whole lot of detail of like what, how exactly he was supposedly doing that. In 2019, John filed a whistleblower complaint alleging workers were being encouraged to cut corners on manufacturing processes, leading to really severe issues with their planes. Earlier this month, John was found dead from a supposedly self-inflicted gunshot wound in his car in Charleston, South Carolina. Shortly before that, according to WCIV, the ABC affiliate in Charleston, he told a family friend that if something happened to him, it was not suicide. So I don't really know what exactly this proves. I mean, he was clearly like some sort of disgruntled employee back in 2017. I think it's a little bit more evidence that there was just some like weird stuff going on there potentially. And again, it just adds up to like, certainly, you know, someone who was being, you know, harassed and like all these things happening over and over and over again, like certainly could have been, you know, unfortunately, like, let, you know, pushed to taking their own life. But it just doesn't feel that way. Like, it feels like there's something there that just we need to uncover here, and someone's gonna do it at some point.
I just feel like the, I'm using this term loosely, but like the paper trail here with like what was documented in that lawsuit in 2017 and like, you know, him coming forward with these complaints after he retired and then what he told the friend, like all of that is pointing to one thing. So like, I feel like if he did, if it was suicide, I feel like there would have been a note.
I do. I feel like every time that I read about someone committing suicide, and it's like they're trying to figure out whether or not it's suicide or whether or not it's not suicide. And I don't know the statistics, and I wish I did, but like it's some like astronomical number that there's some sort of evidence that they've been unhappy or like or you know leading to committing to taking their own life beforehand, or B, there's like some astronomical number that there's always a note when someone does that like details why it happened, apologizing to their friends, like this is just like psychologically what you know suicide victims do, and there was none of that. And like again, I go back to, so we talked about this last week about the gun, right? There was and that the statistics behind that are like you know telling of like that it was like I think like some 75% of suicide victims where they use a gun, like the gun will not be in their hand. It'll like fly out of their hand. And in this case, John's gun was very much so, his alleged gun was very much so still in his hand in the car. And that to me is like the biggest piece of evidence that there's just something not right here. Because it seems like if someone wants to stage that, like that's what they would do without knowing that the science does not back that up.
Just from what we do know about him, he seems like an outspoken person. If he has something to say, he's going to say it. So if it's going to be the last thing that he ever says before taking his own life, I feel like he's the type of person that would put it in a note.
Right, that part.
And that's not here, you know?
I also feel like he might be the kind of person who, if he felt was being tracked or harassed or whatever, would do that in an encrypted fashion, either in an encrypted message itself or possibly like mailing it to someone else to arrive at a later date.
Sure.
So that might be like maybe it just hasn't been uncovered yet.
Yeah, it's possible. I could see that potentially. But also, I mean, going back to like, you know, normal behaviors, like he just didn't really seem like the type. And like, again, we don't know this dude, obviously. We didn't know this dude. And we're certainly stereotyping here and like, you know, painting this with like a broad stroke kind of thing. But he also, if you're like outspoken enough to like take on Boeing, like the most powerful manufacturer in the world, and you're like getting all these balls rolling that like you're in the middle of this lawsuit, you're doing all this stuff, you clearly didn't mind speaking up in 2019, even though you knew that you saw what managers were doing to you in 2017 and before that. And so why was this the breaking point? Like, it just didn't really seem to make sense to me. And like, again, like, so like I would love to know more about like why he was staying in that hotel, because if you remember, he was in the hotel, they saw him you know, the morning he was supposed to check out and the evening after he was already supposed to be checked out, and they found all of his belongings inside of the hotel room. But like, he was supposedly from Charleston, like the hotel was in Charleston. It's just odd. It's just, there's just a lot of like very odd things that just don't really make sense as to like why they were all happening. Like, it seems like he was just in like persistently these like very weird situations that just did not seem like him.
Has there been any reporting on the gun and who it was registered to? Like, was it his personal firearm?
I have not seen that. I have not seen that just yet. That would be a really interesting question. I would also be curious about that. I'm sure they're trying to figure that out to a certain extent. And like, I'll also say too, to be clear, the Charleston Police Department is very much so still investigating this. The medical examiner ruled it a suicide, but the Charleston Police Department very much so still has this open. And so there's going to be more, I'm sure, coming out of that at some point.
I'm just really interested in what else is going to unfold out of this situation.
Yeah. Well, and again, like going back to like my, like, you know, my low country roots in terms of my crime loving, and like, it just feels like another one of those Murdoch situations, right? Like it where things are just looking weird and powerful people and all that stuff. And I'm getting my blood flowing all over again, just like I was when all the Murdoch stuff was popping off. So I'll be here. I will be here to keep y'all updated. In the meantime, Michelle, speaking of a case I'm obsessed with, this is also a case that I've become obsessed with. What do you have this week?
Yes. So 4 weeks after disappearing from his Middle Tennessee bedroom, the search for an autistic teenager seems to be ramping up again. State investigators have had no credible tips or sightings of Sebastian Rogers since his mother reported him missing on February 26th. Now the United Cajun Navy is joining in on the search. I had never heard of that organization, so I kind of wanted to know a little bit more. I found out that they're an all-volunteer organization. They typically respond to natural disasters across the country, but they also do help in search and rescue missions in missing persons cases. Now, the organization posted on social media that they have deployed a search team and 5 canines to help with the search for Sebastian. Now, this weekend, things have been changing literally by the hour. There have been reports of searches taking place at a nearby area. It's called Rockland Recreation Area. This is in Hendersonville. The area has been closed off to the public because a tornado hit in December. It's about 30 minutes away from Sebastian's home, which is where he was last seen. A true crime independent reporter, her name is Lulu Rose, she posted on X over the weekend that cadaver dogs hit on a shallow grave in that recreation area. But this is what's insane, is the Sumner County Sheriff's Office and the TBI, they are not confirming anything, and they've actually asked the United Cajun Navy to leave. So it's kind of like, you know, if dogs hit and there was this shallow grave of some recently disturbed dirt, you know, and these dogs are hitting on it, why wouldn't you kind of go all in and see what's going on? And there's been a lot of conspiracy theories as to why some people think that might happen. But either way, it's just, you know, here you are, you have a group of volunteers who are here. They have, you know, some resources. Why not utilize them? You know what I mean? Why not put them to work so that it can help bring Sebastian home?
Yeah, I don't know if you saw me furiously writing down notes as you were talking, Michelle. But yeah, because I saw that shallow grave reporting as well, also from Lulu Rose. And that's when I was like, wait. But I saw this morning, so much has been evolving over today, meaning Sunday. It doesn't make any sense to ask them to go home unless you know something, right? Unless there's information out there that is leading something to this. And to be clear, they haven't really, this is just this reporter kind of throwing this in here about the shallow grave. There's nothing really confirming that this is involved in any way. It could not be. It feels like, because if you remember, I'm sure, Michelle, when Sebastian Rogers first went missing, we were talking about he'll be found, it seems like just one of those situations that it's just a misunderstanding, blah, 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 whatever, or just a weird situation. But the more that this has gone on, it has just been so crystal clear to me anyways, that there's something more here that is going to come out. I don't know what the heck that is, but it's so clear to me that there's just something that's gonna come out of this that is gonna make me really angry, but make a lot of sense, in my opinion.
Kind of the dynamic with the parents. So Sebastian's biological parents were divorced, and at first we saw a lot of the mom and the stepdad doing interviews and things like that. And now they've kind of taken a step back, and now we're seeing more of Sebastian's biological dad. He's been out in Nashville and stuff, handing out flyers, and it seems like now he's being more involved, and it really hasn't come across like they're a united front, which I think is interesting. Obviously we don't know what their relationship has been like, but I feel like at the end of the day, if you have a teenage child with autism that has disappeared in the middle of the night, you know, I kind of feel like normally you would probably see a united front with all three parents, but we haven't seen that in this case. So I don't know. It I think it's just been interesting at how his mom and stepdad have taken a step back when on the front end we were seeing them a lot and hearing from them a lot.
I feel like from the crime cases that I've covered, Michelle, with like divorced parents and that kind of stuff, I feel like that's kind of been like the couple that are kind of coming to mind offhand. Like, I feel like that's kind of how it's been in terms of like, there's like the mom, there's like, you know, step parents or like the biological mother and the, you know, stepfather or, you know, vice versa. And then there's like a divorce in the family or like whatever, you know, strained relationship. And like, I feel like it's like they come together for like a week or two and then when it like, it just becomes too hard, right? Where it's like, this is clearly like unstable relationships. And then at some point they just kind of like, you know, go their separate ways kind of thing. And it like, I feel like I've seen that. I feel like I've seen that quite a bit where it's like, it's, you know, strained relationships and it just is too much for them to handle, to like, you know, to go about this, you know, to deal with the differences they've already had. And then on top of this, you know, put themselves into like the most stressful situation imaginable. I feel like I've seen that pretty often.
Some of the old issues and old maybe scars and pain kind of bubbling up out of those emotions of fear and panic and being scared and sad. Like that makes sense. I didn't think about that, but that does make sense. I can see that. One thing that I have wondered is that being that this rec area is 30 minutes away from their home, it's in Hendersonville. It does, and it's been closed off to the public because of the tornado. It does make you wonder, like, has it been searched before? I mean, I also understand from a law enforcement perspective, if they don't really have like a reason to go search that area, you know what I mean? I get that. But also, like, I remember his parents saying that he did like water, you know, I guess the question would be, well, then how would he get there? I don't know. I wonder if that area has already been searched before or not.
Yeah. Well, and I think in my brain, it would be like clearly somebody was involved in his disappearance if there was a shallow grave involved kind of thing. But also I just have to go down the rabbit hole or the path or the theory here that like the shallow grave has nothing to do with Sebastian, only because I feel like they would have said if they found him in that grave. No, unless they're like really like still trying to like confirm whether or not it's like whoever is in there, if there's someone in there, if that it's him or not, you know what I mean?
Or even that, you know, that it was human.
Yeah.
You
know, or even that there was anyone in there. Right. Yeah.
So that Amber Alert for Sebastian is still active in Tennessee. If you have any information about where he may be, call 1-800-TBI-FIND. And Heather, what do you have for us this week?
A 1998 Kansas City murder is officially solved after the suspect's husband teamed up with police. Randall Oliphant was a 26-year-old when he disappeared in January of 1998. He was last seen leaving a gay bar in the downtown area. Two fishermen discovered Oliphant's body 2 months later in a wooded area in Warsaw. That's about 100 miles from Kansas City. Investigators found shotgun pellets in the decomposing body, but over time, the case went cold. That is until a California doctor went to police, claiming his husband confessed to killing Oliphant. According to court documents, Timothy Stevenson told his husband in 2014 that he shot Oliphant as he begged for his life and then disposed of his body. Investigators had eyed Stevenson as a suspect years ago, but never had evidence to charge him. This new information led to an undercover operation in 2021 where Stevenson's husband wore a mic to record their conversation. KY3 reports Stevenson admitted to being with Oliphant before he disappeared. And during this time, investigators also resubmitted DNA for testing, which placed Oliphant in Stevenson's old Jeep. Stevenson was arrested in California in December of 2021 and extradited to Missouri. A grand jury indicted him on second-degree murder charges in 2022. Stevenson pleaded guilty on March 15th, avoiding a trial. He was sentenced to 16 years in jail.
I wonder why, like, is it because, like, all this time has passed since 1998 that, like, he got a lesser sentence? I mean,
I didn't see any reporting on why it was just 16 years. It was a second degree murder charge. And besides the evidence of the shotgun pellets that were recovered from the victim's body, the only new DNA they had was Oliphant's blood placing him in Stevenson's Jeep. But that doesn't necessarily prove that that's where the crime scene was, that he had a body in there, just that he had been in there at some point. And then there are also reports that during the undercover operation, there were some conflicting statements by Stevenson. So maybe that led to it being second degree murder and not first degree or something higher than that. And obviously, since he took a plea and didn't go to trial, it feels like there was some kind of deal made there.
Yeah, and I feel like also, I mean, you see like these cases years later too, where like where the sentence is much lesser. So maybe that has, like, maybe it's just like they don't, like, prosecutors probably don't want to go to trial either because it's been so long, and, you know, they clearly didn't have enough before, and so why is this so strong? This doesn't really seem to be substantially stronger, you know what I mean? Especially if he's going to dispute it. So it's like, I feel like a lot could go wrong in this type of situation. So I suppose that makes sense. And like, he's much older now as well. But man, I mean, this is why I don't go to gay bars. But also, this is why I also say, like, you know, it's never too late for a case to come back around and, you know, and for justice to be served. I mean, I've covered cases back into the 20s where I've said the same thing. Not to say that those cases have ever really been solved, but like, it could happen is the point.
Can you imagine how difficult it had to be for his spouse to go to investigate and be like, he said he killed someone? Like, because they had adopted two daughters and were raising two children together. The suspect's husband did eventually ask for a divorce. So obviously it wasn't the best relationship in the world, but it still had to be very difficult to go to law enforcement with that.
To be clear, if my future husband's listening to this and you tell me you've murdered someone, I will turn you in. Just to be clear, because I feel like I would attract a murderer. Just I want to be like crystal clear about that. So like, I have no problem with that in any way, shape, or form. But yeah, I mean, it's like, to be clear. But also to that point though too, Heather. Like, yeah, I mean, it's like these intimate relationships. I mean, you go back. I mean, this happened years ago. Like, I mean, disruptive to your own life at the same time. And so there's a certain level of bravery there. And like, who knows, what if this wasn't enough to put him away? And then, but like, you know that this happened, and like, and you know, who knows if this guy would have come after you next because you tried to turn him in unsuccessfully. So it's like, it does take a certain amount of bravery there as well, especially considering it sounds like he now has to raise multiple children on his own. So yeah.
That's what I was going to say, is like, just having that on your conscience and like just being afraid. Like, I don't know. I wouldn't want that on, like, just knowing that. And I would just, the courage that it took to speak up.
But this is like a rare instance, at least in this version of the podcast, where there is some closure. So at least there is that. Someone is paying the consequences of their actions.
Thank you, Heather, for bringing us a case that we can feel good about.
You're welcome.
For once.
It won't happen again.
I didn't think so. Well, speaking of cases without a firm ending, coming up right after the break, we have some missing people to tell you all about that you can take action on right now. Have you seen Melody Darinet, the latest on an active search for the missing teenager from Pennsylvania? Get ready for that big test with Study.com. Study.com offers learning materials and test prep, even LSAT study prep guides for all of my legal nerds listening. Unfortunately, there aren't any wine study guides, and believe me, I did check. Listeners can get 30% off their first 3 months of any subscription level using the promo code CRIMEOVERWINE. Again, that's promo code CRIMEOVERWINE, no spaces, for 30% off your first 3 months at Study.com. Learn faster, stay motivated, study smarter with our sponsor, Study.com.
Hey,
Hello, everybody. This is Liam Collins, the host of the podcast Crime Over Wine, and I'm about to make your Wine Wednesdays so much better. We know that there is nothing better than hanging out and listening to your favorite true crime podcast over your favorite bottle of wine, and that's where we come in. Every week, we share a new head-scratching true crime story while reviewing your new favorite bottle of wine. So your new true crime adventure is waiting for you. Crime Over Wine drops new episodes every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
A family in Denver is desperate to find their 13-year-old son. Diego Hernandez has been missing since December 1st of 2023. Diego was last seen on surveillance video leaving his home in the middle of the night. The video shows him putting on a jacket, grabbing a bike, and then hopping over a fence to the home. Diego's mom says her son has never done anything like this before and that everything was normal the night before her son's disappearance, adding that the family had dinner together before going to bed. Now, just last week, Diego's mom was passing out flyers in Denver. She says that she is determined to find her son. She told a local Denver affiliate, "I try to work. I try to make it as normal as possible for the kids to go to school and to have some routine. But when we are missing a missing piece, it's just not the same." Now, I was surprised to find this out as I was doing research on this case. On March 21st, so just a couple of days ago, his family was notified by law enforcement that he was spotted in Grand Junction, Colorado. So this is about 3 hours and 45 minutes away from Denver, which is where his family lives. His sister posted on social media he was spotted in a car with a group of people. And obviously, his family is worried about the intentions of these people. They don't know who they are or what he might be doing out in Grand Junction, Colorado, but this is a 13-year-old boy, and I watched the surveillance video myself, and it seemed like he was, like, in a hurry. Like, he was, like, running and putting on the jacket and, like, grabs this bike and is running over the fence and hopping over it. So it's like he's trying to leave quickly. This was around 4 o'clock in the morning, again, December 1st. So it's just, it's crazy, and it's kind of like some of the other cases that we've talked about in previous weeks. Like, yeah, the kids might run away from home, but whoever may have convinced them, you know, to come with us, like, when you're trying to do that to a child, a teenager, and take them away from their family and everything that they know, and you know, they don't have any contact with their family, don't tell them where they're going, what they're doing. People that take advantage of that vulnerability, to me, that's a scary person. That's not somebody that you should trust. But that's hard when you're a teenager, you know what I mean? Because kids are just very trusting. And as they start to get older and start to really crave that independence, that can be taken advantage of. And it sounds like that may be what happened in this case.
Well, but, and regardless on that point too, Michelle, like, regardless of whether they went willingly, whether they went, you know, did whatever, wanted to run away from home, they are a minor and they can't consent to that kind of thing. They don't have that choice. They live with their caregiver, right? And so that's just how that works. But I also think too, again, going back to, like, the Johnny Gosch case, right? Where in that case, we had so many sightings that, you know, seemed to, according to law enforcement, seemed to be Johnny, more than likely, but who knows, right? And so, like there are a lot of types of situations where kids are assumed to have run away, but how do you know for sure, especially 3.5 hours away? Presumably no one really, you know, the person who saw this person is just saying that they, you know, match Diego's description, but who's to say for sure, right? Like, I just feel like there's still, like, a certain level of skepticism that I have around those types of situations, and reasonably so, because it very much so, like, still opens the door for me. Like, sure, like maybe he's in Grand Junction, but maybe he's not.
And the family, like, as I was reading, like, the post that the family made, they had no idea until law enforcement contacted them. So I feel like that gives it a little bit more credibility. But it's kind of, in situations like this, at least there's been a sighting, you know, a sighting is better than none.
Sure.
But I do agree with you. Like, as a child, like, you might feel like you can make your own decisions and feel like you have a handle on it, but you just don't. That's why you're still a child. You're still considered a child because you are. And I just feel for this mom. Like, you know, here she is just trying to keep the family running, the family going, and she's got a baby out there that she doesn't know where he's at, if he's okay, is he hungry, is he cold, you know, and she's handing out flyers just trying to find her son. And when you look at the pictures, I'll post them on my social media pages, but I mean, he's a young looking 13-year-old. I mean, he looks like just a little boy, and you're just like, oh my gosh, you're out there, and who knows who can take advantage of that. A $2,000 reward is being offered for information about where Diego is. You can call Denver police at 720-913-2000.
Shanta Marie Johnson went missing July 19th, 1992. She was just 3 years old, but had already lived a difficult life. Shanta and her younger brother were born with cocaine in their systems due to their mother's drug use. The siblings were placed in foster care and were in the process of being adopted by their foster parents when Shanta disappeared. Shanta's foster mom, Suzanne Marie Johnson, was the last person to see her. She told investigators Shanta vanished while they were in a Myrtle Beach mall, but surveillance video showed the woman entering the store alone. A month before Shanta disappeared, a nurse filed a report saying the child showed signs of physical abuse and acted fearful. Shanta's babysitter also reported an incident where the toddler appeared to have burns on her bottom. The little girl told the babysitter her foster mom had burned her with hot grease, but Johnson claimed that it was sunburn. The Broken Link Foundation reports Susan Johnson was charged with felony child abuse in 1995. The outcome of that case is unknown, and the Navigating Advocacy podcast reports that both foster parents have since died. Shanta's little brother was removed from the foster home the day after she went missing. He was later adopted by another family. Today, Shanta remains missing. Investigators believe foul play was involved, and they aren't sure the child ever made it to Myrtle Beach. Shanta lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina at the time, and would be 35 years old now. In 1992, she was described as a black girl with black hair and brown eyes. If you have any information about Shanta Marie Johnson's case, contact the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office at 910-321-6565.
Oh my gosh, Heather. This is like such a sad situation.
Yeah, and what's also very sad is it's kind of like after 1995, there really wasn't much reporting on her. There was hardly any reporting in her initial disappearance either. It was reported that December of that year, they had marked the case inactive and had moved on.
Wow. And it's like people were speaking up, it seems like, you know, but it just, nothing came of it.
Yeah, until 3 years later is when she was officially filed. And it was reported that that was for abuse against Shanta and because of those reports.
Wow. I also feel this time was such like a like odd time for reporting these types of situations. I like 80s, 90s was just like, for whatever reason, nobody really wanted to talk about child abuse. It was very much so one of those situations that it was like, okay, was this just like, you know, or are they just being a little too strict? It was just very taboo. And it unfortunately doesn't really necessarily surprise me that they waited that long, because I just feel like it was, you know, that's how long it took to elevate. But I wouldn't be surprised necessarily to know that a lot of people knew about it necessarily.
And she was supposed to have a follow-up appointment with the physician's office that had reported her initial issues a month after she disappeared, but obviously never made it. So I don't know if the mom caught on to people were reporting it or what happened here, but unfortunately Shanta has not been seen, and her foster mom said that she was with her in that mall and that the surveillance video just didn't record her because she was so short. But police are like, no, she was not
there.
That's
not how cameras work.
Yeah, you can't be so short that you're non-existent. That's not how that works.
Even in the 90s when the quality wasn't that great. Okay. So Liam, you're also sticking over here in the East Coast with your missing person. Who are you telling us about?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you all about, it's a much shorter case, but I just feel like because of the lack of information, I felt compelled to share it because of that. A lot of times, you know, podcasters will just ignore cases with not a whole lot of information because you can't make an episode out of it. So let's talk about it this time anyways. We're going to Berks County. Pennsylvania police there are looking for 16-year-old Melody Darinette. She was last seen around noon on Saturday, March 9th in the area of Cheltenham Drive in Wyomissing, which is about an hour and a half northwest of Philadelphia. Police say she is considered to be endangered and they believe she may be at, quote, special risk of harm or injury, but they don't really elaborate on what that special harm or injury might be. She is about 5'2", 120 pounds, has black shoulder length hair and brown eyes. If you know anything, call the Wyomissing Police Department at 610-375-6102. So again, not a whole lot of information to be shared here. I will say that I do get the kind of vibe that this could be a runaway situation, that this could be a situation where Melody is not making the best decisions potentially. And it's not really known whether or not she might be with people or whether or not she might be out there on her own. Like, we don't really know for sure. There's a lot to be speculated about, and I haven't really seen much from Melody's parents either. Not a whole lot of reporting on it, and the little reporting that there is says almost exactly what I said right now. The Black and Missing Foundation did pick up Melody's case and posted about it as well, and so she's gained that much attention. But out of that, it's really just been like a couple of, you know, very short articles written by some local TV stations that have kind of wrapped up the circumstances of her disappearance, you know, really in the who, what, when, where, why type of situation.
I know you said there's not a lot out there, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but the area she was last seen, is that like a neighborhood or more rural, like where someone may have picked her up, like if they thought she was hitchhiking or something?
It's a neighborhood, more of a neighborhood type situation, like more suburban for sure. It's right outside Philadelphia, so definitely not like a rural area at all. What I was curious about is like whether or not that road that I mentioned, Cheltenham Drive, may have been like whether or not that was like what kind of connection she had there. Was that like a home that she was like near a home where she was known to stay in? Like, what did she have friends there, or was it just the last place she was seen? There's not a whole lot of detail about that, unfortunately. And I do feel like that would be good to know.
It's sad to hear that there's not anything out there from her parents, you know, not that they're not worried, but I don't know. It helps keep the story out there and relevant in the media, you know. And what if she were to see something, you know, that, hey, this is mom, this is dad, we love you, we're worried about you, please come back home.
Yeah, and again, that goes back to like the lack of information that we have out there. So that like leads a lot to be speculated about, but it also leads me to believe potentially that, you know, the home life may not have been great, right? And like, again, I go back to like the fact that like I am suspicious that, you know, Melody might not be making the best of decisions, and who knows what the parents know about the circumstances surrounding her going missing or what have you. Again, someone reported her missing, so someone cared about her or cares about her. So, you know, I put that much stake into it, but so who really knows what the underlying circumstances are. But I hope that she, if she's okay and she's out there, she's, you know, going through something, that she finds a way back. And if there's something a little bit more there, then I hope that, you know, at some point, to your point, Michelle, that does happen. So that way people, you know, do get the word out about her. And so we can see your face and see your name and et cetera.
I agree. Her story deserves to be told.
Again, I'll say, if you know anything about Melody's disappearance, call the Wyomissing Police Department. That number is 610-375-6102. But for now, that is all that we have for you this week. Another week under our belts doing this thing. It's so great talking with you guys every week. Just have to say that.
It's my favorite part of the week. Just saying.
Oh, love that for us.
I tolerate you. I'm just kidding. I love y'all.
We're moving in the right direction for our relationship. Now we're on to toleration. I love that. Well, thank you all for listening, everybody. If you can't get enough of Crime Over Wine, follow all of us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we will see you next Monday for the next episode of Crime Over Wine Weekly. And we will see you this Wednesday for your regularly scheduled episode of Crime Over Wine.
proud member of the Podnougan Network.